Hello, and welcome to Sobercast. We provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in a podcast format. We are an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into the virtual basket. Also, if you're a member of NA or have friends that are, please tell them about our other podcast, NAPOD. NAPOD features NA speakers and workshops in the same format as Sobercast. We upload a new speaker every day, and it's easy to subscribe by searching for NAPOD, N-A-P-O-D, all one word, on any podcast player app, or go to napod.xyz if you'd like to listen online. Hope you enjoy the podcast, and have a great day.
They work really well with the outfit, but not on these sunburned feet. I'm Jessica. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is April 17th, 2006. I have a home group. It is the White Rose Group of Alcoholics Anonymous on Friday nights in York, PA at 8 p.m. If you leave on Friday morning about 1 a.m., you can probably get there on time. Did I tell you my sobriety date? Cool. All right. Have a sponsor, and I have the privilege of sponsoring other women in this fellowship. So I'll tell you, my job is to tell you just a little bit about what I was like, what happened, and most importantly now, what I'm like today. And I grew up in a very loving home. My parents are still married today. I talk to them every day while I was here, and I have a brother who I absolutely adore and followed around since the moment I could walk, which he really appreciates. He loves that. And I had the setup. I had everything that should make me content and happy as a kid, and I don't ever remember being content and happy. From the age of five, I remember just being a really, like, those are my first memories, and I remember being extremely fearful about everything. And my dad is epileptic, and he had just started having these really severe grandma seizures, which are quite traumatic even as an adult. But as a little kid, you know, when I think about it now, I didn't think at all about how it was affecting my mom, who, you know, it had gone away and come back when they first got married. I didn't think about that. I didn't think about how it affected my brother. As far as I was concerned, they were doing fine, but I was falling apart on the inside, just full of fear. And he was put on a bunch of different medications, and he slept a lot, and he was very volatile and angry, and that doesn't make me alcoholic, but I definitely used that to explain away my drinking for a long time. And I was not comfortable, and I made up, like, I had friends in school and stuff, but I made up my own little world of imaginary friends, and I had a group of them, and they were awesome, because, like, I just created this world that I could just go to, and I was so lonely, like, all the time, but I loved being alone, and I don't know if that makes any sense, but it definitely made sense to me, and it was very, very real to me. My mom sat on one of them one time, and I was just fell apart because of that. And she had to set a place for them at the dinner table, and it was just very real to me. So I was very delusional from a very young age. And my first drink was about when I was like eight. My parents are not drinkers. They would have a sip of wine here and there on the holidays, and they would let us taste it. And there was a bottle of wine in our fridge, and there was nobody around. And I loved the way that it tasted, and so I got the idea to help myself. And it's so crazy, because even at that young age, I remember I took the first sip, and then I sat down in my dad's recliner, and I was watching the TV, and I couldn't stop thinking about it. It's in the fridge. I just want another taste. It was really good. And so I went back out to the fridge, and I took the next couple gulps, and then I went back into the living room. And that, like, continued until my legs became rubber, and I really couldn't make it out to the kitchen so well. So I just flipped my dad's recliner back, and I was like, oh, I was so relaxed and warm. Like, I remember feeling like that very clearly. And but, you know, like, at 8 years old, you don't really have the opportunity to get much alcohol. So I wasn't like an instant everyday drinker. But I was a compulsive liar from, I remember first grade on the way to school, you know, I guess I just never thought that I was good enough, and so I always had to make something up. Ridiculous stuff that, like, you know, I thought everybody believed. And I was on the way to school one day, and I told my friend that my grandpa had a unicorn, and he was in a barn, and she couldn't see him. He was sick. But, like, I would make stuff up like that all the time because I just didn't feel like enough, you know. And I thought I was pulling one over on everybody, you know, until I talk to my new girls now, and they don't pull the unicorn thing, but they do lie a lot, and I never really pull that one over on me. But so school was, like, really uncomfortable for me, you know, and somewhere along the line I got the idea that boys would fix me, and my body was not cooperating, you know. I was, like, really awkward, like I think pretty much everybody is, and, like, fifth and sixth grade, and I had, like, this awesome permed hair, and my fifth grade school picture, I have, like, this awesome perm, and my mom took my junior bridesmaid dress from my cousin's wedding. It was pink taffeta, hot, and she cut it off so I could wear it to my school pictures, which was really nice of her. And then my sixth grade year, like, and I never looked good enough. I always had to change my appearance, and I'd become, like, even more, like, not okay with the way that I looked. So we cut the permed hair. It was, like, up here, and I had purple glasses. And I asked my mom, like, why did you let me get purple glasses? She's like, you threw a fit in the middle of the store. So, you know, I blamed her for a long time for the purple glasses, and it was all my fault. I had a tendency to be a spoiled brat, and still do sometimes. But so when I get to junior high, I decide that the glasses aren't as important as, you know, the boys. So I shed the glasses, and I couldn't see, and I started to get boyfriends. And, you know, I thought it was because I lost the glasses, but it was probably because, like, my approval rating just went, you know, like, whoever, come on in, you know, because I can't really see you anyway. But ridiculous, man, ridiculous, because the appearance on the outside was what I thought would make me feel better on the inside. And then it was the boys, and then it was, you know, whatever, something outside of myself is going to make me feel better. And, like, I couldn't have told you that any of this stuff was going on at the time. You know, I can only see it more clearly now. So I got into high school and, you know, was scared to death. And it was, I don't like change, and it was just a bigger place and a lot more people. And I dropped my books on, like, the first day of school. I was lost. I dropped my books, and a senior picked them up for me, and I was like, thank you. And on the inside, I'm thinking, he loves me. He's in love with me. He picked up my books. And so, yeah, I think it was my sophomore or junior, I forget. When I was 16, I found a boy who liked me too, and he lived across the street, which was very convenient, because when I do things, I do them alcoholically. It was every day, all the time. And I remember my mom saying, you know, like, just why don't you just, like, hang out with your friends, like, do your homework, maybe, you know. And I'm like, just, it's good, you know, I got this. And I got pregnant at 16, and that was torturous, because being in high school, like, I already felt completely out of place, awkward, not like anybody else. I just wanted to fit in, and now I'm pregnant. And I remember, you know, like, when I started to show, and, like, near the end of my pregnancy, thinking that everybody was staring at me all the time, and I felt like that anyway, but it was amplified times, like, 1,000. It was just intense. Like, I'd walk through the hallways, and I remember my face burning, like, hot red, because I was just so worried about what everybody thought about me. And not the way I was raised, you know. I wasn't raised to spend every day, all day with the boy. And you know, my parents tried to instill good morals and values in me, and just took me a little longer to put those into practice. But so I decided, and this is where God has been in my life since the beginning, and I believe that I have been in the palm of his hand since the beginning. I absolutely believe that. And he allowed me, helped me, by the grace of God, gave me the ability to place my son with an adoptive family, which I am a selfish and self-centered person. I am not capable of a selfless decision like that. But I did make that decision with his help, didn't ask for it, gave it to me anyway, and I placed my son with a family. So once I had that solution, I just wanted to get through it, just walk through it, get through school, get through the tutoring and the outside stuff. When I get back to school, everything's going to be awesome. Like, everything was going to be completely different. You know, I was going to feel completely different. I was going to be skinny again. I got my hair cut, you know, so I could go back to school looking fly. And I don't even think we had that word then, but anyway, I went back to school, and the first day I went back to school was like, like, this was not what I was expecting. You know, like, I thought everything was going to be different, and it wasn't. And so I quickly turned to drinking. You know, while I was pregnant, again, the grace of God in my life, I didn't partake. My friends were into it, and I was like, keep it away from me. I don't want anything to do with it. I didn't want anything to do with drinking until I tried it. And then I loved it, and nothing would get in the way of my drinking ever again. And I made sure of that, and I made a lot of sacrifices, you know, to make sure that that never happened. And in my senior year, I went to this post-prom party, and I had a boy with me, and he called me the next day, and he's like, I think maybe we should not see each other. I think you have a drinking problem. Like, that was one of the first times that I had drunk, you know, like, except for when I was, like, 8, which didn't really count anyway. Like, I had never even tried it, and I had just found, like, I'm like, this is the love of my life. Like, you can go. Even though, like, he dumped me, I was like, I was going to do that anyway. But, you know, there was no way that somebody, I mean, from the first moment, you know, like, I had forgotten patches of the night, and, you know, I just thought I was forgetful, and it would come to me later. Anyway, that was, you know, whatever, but he was a loser. And so, just kidding, that's not nice. So we're getting ready to graduate, and I could barely make it to school. I mean, I made it in time for home ec. We'd hang out in the parking lot, and then we'd go in and eat. It was awesome. But it was really convenient my senior year. It popped up just in time. And, you know, everybody's graduating, and they're going to college, and they're going in the military, and they got good jobs or whatever. And I'm like, suckers, I'm going to party. And I got a job at a pharmacy, which is awesome for an alcoholic like me. And I just fell into it. It was cool. So quickly, you know, my work ethic was not great. I would show up to work. I'd sleep under the desk because I was a supervisor, so there was no one else there, and I'd lock myself in the office and I'd sleep under the desk, and I would take what wasn't mine, and from the pharmacy and from the store, and like whatever you had, it was mine. You don't pay me enough. I come here every day when I want to, you know, like, I felt like they owed me that, and I definitely, I don't know, like, I don't really think that there was, at the time, I didn't really think there was anything wrong with it, and I had this boss who took a liking to me for some reason, because I am a good worker when I show up. I am. I can be a good worker, and when I'm not sleeping under the desk, and he liked me, and I hung out with him and his wife, and I hung out with his kid, and we just became fast friends, and he moved to another pharmacy, and I had decided to go back to school, and it was going to work better with my schedule, and it was another pharmacy, so, you know, I had no problem leaving the first one, and I just continued to do, like, I hadn't suffered any consequences, so I just continued to do what I was doing before, and this one day, the district manager comes in, and, like, I knew as soon as she was there that something was up, and they took me into the back room, and they're like, do you know of anybody in here that has stolen from the store? And I'm like, oh, like, who could do such a thing? I'm going through the people in the store that I work with. I was literally going through their faces like a Rolodex, like, I don't think she would. He probably wouldn't. And I'm like, well, I have. You know, not talking about me, but I'll just put it out there, and turns out they were talking about me, and I got fired, and, But like, when, you know, when she told me, like, she started to like pull all of this stuff out of a garbage, because I'm not very sneaky, you know, like I'll just ditch it wherever. And she started to pull all this stuff out, and what happened is I started to see like myself out in front of me on this table, like all the stuff that I had done and thought that nobody saw, and if nobody saw it, then I didn't really do it. And when I got caught, it sucked. And I had just found out I was pregnant again, and I was about 23, so I'm going to college. I know I'm going to have to stop going to college to at least have this baby, and thank God I got fired from that job, because that baby is healthy. He's 7 now, and he just turned 7, and I don't know if that would have happened if I would have continued to do the things that I was doing. And so God saved his little life, and I thank him for that. And so the boss told me, you know, we'll send you a packet since you were honest. And the packet showed up in the form of a constable, and he came knocking at my door. And I'm like, I thought they were sending me a packet. He's like, you have to come with me. And it was just, you know, when I was faced with myself, like, I just could, eventually it would just get covered up again. You know, I would just drink more, I would just go out and hang out with the boys more, I would do whatever, spend money more, whatever it took to cover it up, that's what I would do, because I would just was not ready to look at myself or the things that I was doing. And my life was a little unmanageable, you know. So I jumped through the hoops, and I prayed through the drug tests, and I got through that program that they offered me, and my record was taken care of. And again, like, I just kind of just missed the consequences, you know. And so things, after I had my second son, who is also with an adoptive family, which, I don't know, man, I always share it in my story, and I think it's because it's two of the most powerful times that God worked in my life. The second time around was even harder than the first. And I just remember every day I asked God to kill that child. That's how selfish I was. And I drank at the beginning of that pregnancy. And, you know, like I said, he's healthy. And I just thank God for that, you know. And I talked to his mom. And it's just an awesome situation, you know. And God's blessing was upon that whole situation. And I'm thankful for that, but I was not done drinking. And it just got worse after that. And I went to, you know, whatever you had that would make me feel better, the fastest I would do it. And I got in really deep, and I got in a really sick relationship. And, you know, it was miserable, and it was violent, and it was, you know, all the things that I signed up for at the time. And I was always the victim, and, you know, and my mom and dad would bail me out time after time after time, you know, like, I want to leave them again, you know. And they would come to my rescue, and, you know, they always thought it was him, you know. And I went to a meeting or two in the other fellowship for him. You know, I wanted to raise my hand and be like, I'm here for him. Like, I didn't want any of you people thinking that I was one of you. And, because I was always worried about what people thought of me, always. I thought you were always thinking about me. Why shouldn't you be? I'm just kidding. Just kidding. So that got really nasty, and the things that we were doing brought me to my knees really quick. I got in trouble with the law again, and I don't remember the exact series of events, you know, but there were a couple of things that just made me sink to my knees and say, I can't do this anymore. I was stealing again. I have a problem with that when I'm drinking, and I got caught. They caught me on camera, and the boyfriend, you know, I just bailed him out of jail with some money that I had stolen. And he's like, you might want to lay low for a while. I saw you on TV. And I was like, who are you? So, like, that was, like, one of the first things. And then he dumps me, which might not seem like a big deal to you guys, but this guy was, like, scum of the earth. You know what I mean? Like, I knew how to pick them. I picked them so that they would make me feel just a little bit better about myself. And to do that, they had to be, like, in the gutter. I just pull them out, and you're going to be my boyfriend. he wasn't in the gutter yet when I met him. So then my mom calls me and says, why aren't you at work? It's like, you know, and she said, yeah, you were in the paper, and they came looking for you at your work. And I had ditched work yet again. It happened all the time. I couldn't show up for anything, and if I did, I had to get out of there. You know, almost as soon as I showed up, I couldn't show up for my family. I definitely couldn't show up for work, and when I did, it wasn't on time, and it probably wasn't sober. So they had come looking for me, and the idea to turn myself in didn't seem like a good one to me. But my mom, you know, thought it was a good idea, and you know, I really believe that God was working in my life then too. And so I went to the police station, I turned myself in, and they started to show me pictures of what they had caught on camera. And I mean, they caught me in mid-snatch with a purse in my hand. Like, I was like, I couldn't believe that it was me. You know what I mean? Like, it was just so different when I was doing it than when I saw it, like, in front of me. And I'm serious, because I needed it at that moment. And, you know, so they said, we're not gonna take you in. We'll give you a call. I know how that turned out last time. But I was like, cool, you know. So I went home, and somewhere along the line, I called my mom one day. And this is all very close together, and I said, I need help. My mom's like, I know. And again, I thought I was pulling one over on them, you know. And I wasn't ever fooling them. And the amount of pain that I caused them, like, in being sober just, you know, a little bit, I have had the experience now of people really close to me, you know, with maybe even a couple years sobriety, relapsing, we don't know where they are. And I can't imagine what my parents went through on a daily basis. And all of the hours of sleep that they lost, and every heart-stopping phone call. You know, I'm sure every time the phone rang that they were thinking, I hope Jess is okay. And because that's just the kind of parents God gave me. And so I told her that I needed help. And she said, we'll get you some help. And it wasn't quick enough. And I think, like, as soon as I got off the phone, I opened up the medicine cabinet and I just took everything that was in it. And this was a regular occurrence for me, and so it was showing up in the psych ward. So I ended up in the psych ward for the fourth time because of an attempt on my life. And, like, suicide was a daily obsession for me just as much as the drink. I thought about it when I woke up. I thought about it before I went to bed, and I prayed that God would end my life because it was miserable. It wasn't worth living. I would look at other people and wonder how they did that. Like, how do you grocery shop? How do you show up for work? Like, how do you have a conversation and act like everything's okay? Because I'm not okay. I am not okay. And so I was in the psych ward again, and, you know, like, I loved the psych ward. The fourth time I was there, it's getting to be a bit much, but I loved it because I made lots of friends there because they couldn't get out. They didn't really have a choice. That just kind of dawned on me. I thought they were friends. They couldn't get out. And they gave me your meds, you know, because I needed lots of them. You know, there's more things wrong with me than alcoholism. And I got a bed to sleep in, and three hot meals a day that I got to choose on the menu. And, you know, I even got a razor if I signed it out. So it worked fine for me, you know, because I didn't have that stuff at home. So this time was a little different, you know. I still can't explain where the motivation came from, and so I just say that it was the grace of God in my life. I had reached that point of desperation. I had reached that point where I could no longer go on drinking the way I was drinking, but I could not imagine not drinking. That was my solution. That's what I ran to, and I didn't know what to do. And so I got a bed in rehab, and they told me it was the last day that I could be in the psych ward with my insurance. I was there for 2 weeks, and I'm all on the phone with my mom. I got a bed in rehab, you know, like jumping up and down in the psych ward. And it wasn't that big a deal. They already thought I was crazy. So but that was the insanity of my life at that point in time, that was the quality of my life. I got a bed in rehab, and I was joyous over the occasion. And I got to rehab, and it was very scary for me. It was a lot of people's, a lot of different personalities, and I was so worried about what everybody was thinking about me. And they showed me the schedule, and I remember being so overwhelmed by the schedule. And what it ended up being was us like sitting in a seat for 16 hours a day, and like we'd break for meals and we'd go out for cigarette breaks. But I was just so overwhelmed. I'm like, oh my God, where's my buddy? Because they'd assign you a buddy for the first day or two to show you around, show you the ropes of the rehab. And but what I found there for the first time that I had never experienced was the camaraderie that I soon found in Alcoholics Anonymous. There was a camaraderie there. Like, don't get me wrong, we had our like meetings that were like just sitting in the cesspool of misery. But there were people that came in from the outside who talked about the way that I felt, and I could tell very clearly that they didn't feel that way anymore. And they told me, about their experience. And I met my sponsor in rehab. She came in from the outside. And I don't remember anything she said, but I do remember her face and her eyes. And I knew that she had something that I didn't. So they tell me that they're going to send me back to York, Pennsylvania, which is where I have lived my whole life. And I was okay with that. They told me they were going to put me in a recovery house. I was okay with that because I knew nothing about them. No, the recovery house saved my life. York has it's about 70 plus recovery houses. It's an awesome little pocket of enthusiasm. And who knew? Like, I grew up there. I never knew that all these people were in recovery. And that's amazing to me. And so I get into the recovery house, and I walk in the front door, and there is a big dog barking his head off at me, and the walls are bright yellow, and it was really overwhelming. Everything was just so overwhelming, They should have been black. Like, that's the way I was feeling that day. Everything should have just been muted for me. No, but we sat down with the owner of that recovery house, and I remember some of the things she said because they were outlandish, like 90 and 90, get a sponsor, get a home group, make your bed, make the meals, like are the girls okay with Chef Boyardee? Because I got no skills in that area. Get a job, that was huge for me. I was like, I don't think I can get a job. I've had too many. And everybody in New York knows me, But I did. I got a job. And it was a factory job, and it sucked. And the day that I got the job, I was so grateful to have the job. And by the end of the week, at getting up at 5:30 every morning, I was hating it. And I was miserable, and I was crazy, and my head would not shut up. And I had never experienced that before. I don't think that I had ever stopped doing the things I was doing long enough for that to happen. I don't remember it ever being that loud. And the girls were annoying. I mean, I was not impressed with the idea of living with 8 other women. That's not appealing to me. But I started, I watched these women, and the one girl was going to a meeting early the first night I was there. And for some reason, I was like, I want to go with you. Like, let's go. But she was real happy about that because I latched onto her like white on rice for the next month at least. But we had time to sit down before that meeting. And I don't remember a whole lot of what was said at the beginning of my sobriety. I don't remember what was going on in my head. I don't remember what other people were saying. It was just a bunch of noise. But I remember the way that she made me feel when she talked. Like, I could feel her, And I knew that just like there's other people that had come into the rehab when I was there, I knew that she didn't feel that way anymore. And I remember the look in her eye, and she was staring at me, like looking me in the eyes. And I could not look anybody in the eyes. It was very uncomfortable for me because I felt like if I looked at you too long, you might be able to tell what I was thinking, and that could not happen. I was really full of shame and guilt, and I'm worse than you people, and I've been deeper than you guys have been, and that's just such a big fat lie, I've only shocked the people in AA one time, or my sponsor one time. I've never shot. That's what I was afraid of. I was afraid of somebody be like, no way, you got to get out. You can't tell anybody about that, you know. And that's never really happened. So that's good. But so I picked my sponsor, and this is how I picked her. It wasn't on really spiritual basis. She wore high heels with jeans and totally pulled it off, and she was really pretty. So that's why I picked her to sponsor me. And she's awesome, man. She's awesome. God must have known really what attracted me at the time, because he placed her in my life. And I had switched sponsors, and she's my sponsor again. She's crazy, and I love it because I'm nuts too. And we have a great time, man. We have a women's dinner on Thursday nights that I love to go to. And it's just like a brutally honest, like, it's just a time to just be brutally honest, you know, and just talk about where we're at. And we're reading a new pair of glasses, which I was not happy about, because I don't know, I'm not a very good reader, I don't comprehend very well, and but we've been doing it together, it's been working out really cool. And so anyway, she started to take me through the steps, and I started to get a little bit of relief. And I remember the first time I was going to bed, I spent a little bit of time with God, and then I was laying there, and nothing was going on up here, like nothing. I wasn't even thinking, like, I'm not thinking anything right now. I wasn't thinking anything at all. Like, everything was so quiet, and I was staring at the ceiling like this because I didn't want it to stop. Like, I was afraid if I blinked, it would, you know, the noise would start again. It was awesome, though. It was really cool. But so I started to gain some freedom, you know. So I get past the 30-day blackout. I think it was like the day after the 30-day male blackout that you have in the recovery house. And this guy asked me out on a date. And I was like, well, I don't want to hurt his feelings. And so I was like, okay. I didn't really like him. And how not wanting to hurt his feelings and not really liking him turned into moving in together, getting engaged, and planning on eloping in a matter of 2 months. I don't know. But... felt like a lot longer, you guys. Felt like a lot longer. I was like, we better do this quick before I change my mind. I'm just kidding. What started to happen is, I called my sponsor. I was like, I just moved in with my boyfriend. Like, supposedly you're supposed to run that stuff by your sponsor before you do it. She's like, well, you can always move out. And the apartment started to get smaller and smaller and smaller. And every time I turned around, it was like he was right there. You know, it was like everything that was so freaking cute about him, you know, it was so annoying within a matter of weeks. And he was my solution. And, you know, I wasn't looking for another solution. Like, the steps were starting to work pretty well, but I just got a little detoured. And I have been able to help so many girls with that, man. Every single girl that I sponsor. No, wait. Let me say, I've been able to share that with every girl that I sponsor. I don't know. It's really helped them. They're like, I just moved in with my boyfriend. I'm like, well, you can always move out. So, it was sick. But, so, you know, somewhere, and by the grace of God, man, I tell you, like, I had this little thought in the back of my head. I'm not an audible voice. I don't get those anymore. But I had this little thought in the back of my head, like, recovery house. Like, you need to move back into the recovery house. I'm like, recovery house. And you know, like, I know, for me, that when I start to argue with myself, it's normally God talking to me, you know. Because I don't really argue with myself a whole lot. I argue with him a lot. I'm like, that's not a good idea. I wanted to get an apartment. I was going to save up the money, right? I'm not paying for anything in this apartment. He's paying for everything, and somehow I have no money. And so I get to the point where I'm like, all right, okay, I'll go back and do the 90-90 again. I'll get, you know, whatever I have to do to get away from the situation, because I'm going to drink. And I would have soon. The noise had started. I wasn't sleeping, and I was miserable, and I didn't want to help anybody. And so I moved back into the recovery house, and it was a very humbling experience, you know. But the cool thing about a recovery house is you have a 12-step call dropped off on your doorstep at least once a week, at least. And you know, because they're in and out, like it's a revolving door. So the second time I was at the recovery house, like the first time, you know, I was a little crazy. I was really self-absorbed. This time, like, I was really excited because I had an opportunity right in front of me. I didn't really have to go anywhere to help girls, you know. And so the new girl would come in, and I remember one of them was sitting at the dining room table, and I came home one day, and somebody was like, "Jess, this is your new roommate," and I was like, "Okay." I'm so excited to help her, and she did this. She's like, "Oh my God." And I mean, I had that too when I got here. You know, I had that deer in the headlights look. Like, so, but I was so excited. I was so excited. And they weren't, they were miserable. But so it was a really awesome experience, you know. And I had reached my stay there at the recovery house, and my friend Patty had offered me a place to stay, and I was like, "Let me pray about it," you know. And like a week went by, she calls me and she's like, "How's it, you know, are you gonna move in?" I'm like, "I'm praying about it." She's like, "You're gonna pray yourself right out on the street." So like, well, I guess I'm gonna go move in with her. And I, you know, I just have a lot of fear about change, you know, but it was time for me to go. Like, I had grown all that I believe, you know, God had in store for me at that point in time. And so I moved into her house and lived with a couple girls, and it was awesome. It was awesome, you know, like, to not have to sign out when I left the house. And I just had a little bit more freedom, and like, I just needed that, you know. Like, I needed the structure up until that point. I believe that God had me in every situation, and still does, for the exact right amount of time. And His timing's amazing. And so, you know, I had switched sponsors, like I said, and had gone through the steps again. And I just I don't know. It's been a couple months now that I have my old sponsor again, and sponsoring some other women, and it's really cool, you know. And there's nothing like sitting down with another alcoholic, you know. And at first I was really nervous, you know, and like really scared, and I definitely didn't feel equipped, and I'm not equipped. Like, that's the beauty of it. Like, I've been through the steps. Like, that's all I really need, you know. And God helps me. And I got to a point where I was less and less reliant on my sponsor to help these girls. And you know, I get to see God work. And I had this experience. Like, it was Super Bowl Sunday, actually. It had nothing to do with football because I don't really like it. But I was in church. I since started going back to church. I was there before, and then I, you know, came to AA, and I've just been trying to, you know, for me, that's just where I find more God. And so I was there, and I just, like, for the first time, I used to go to church, and I used to feel so full of guilt and shame that I couldn't stop crying, and I cried through the whole service. And I'm sure people were like, "There's that girl that's crying again." You know, I cried all the time. And now I am definitely still, you know, a crier, but it's because of what God has done in my life. I was hit that day, see, a crier, with the beauty of what God has done in my life. He has completely changed me 180 degrees. I am nothing like the woman that walked in these doors. And I used to think every day about dying. I used to think every day about what you guys thought of me. I used to be consumed by the outside. And I have, for the most part, when I do the things that you have taught me to do, I have a peace and contentment inside that nobody can take from me. And I've been through some stuff in sobriety. You know, we all have. And it just gives me a greater opportunity to get closer to God. And I don't like that. Like, I don't like that I have to walk through the fire to get closer to God. I'm like, why can't you just be on the first, like, at the beginning side of the fire, so I don't even have to walk through it and we'd be all right. But, you know, when you're going through it, people are like, "God's doing something in your life. Aren't you excited?" I'm like, "No, I'm hot. The fire is hot. I don't like it." And then you come out on the other side, and like, those are the periods of the time when I have grown the most, when I have experienced God the closest. And, you know, I still get caught up. I still get caught up in other things, relationships, and I will walk away for a little while, but I just can't stay away. You know, like, I am in love with God. you know, and people like me used to stand up here and say people like things like this, and I'd be like, what? You know, like, these people are so full of crap, like, I can't, because I was miserable, like, I could not understand how 12 steps would make a difference. I'm like, maybe if you had 36, I'm a very complex person, this is a complicated problem, I need a complicated solution, and I didn't believe that just this did not look like anything to me, and it's because I wasn't doing them. And as soon as I started doing them, I'm like, oh, I get it, you know. And you know, I'm just so blessed. It's been like the most amazing, you know, couple of days. We flew in on Friday night, and they told us our plane was going to be delayed because they had to make a repair. Why do you tell people that? But we did get here. Thank God, it was awesome. And I was just like praying that, because like in like PA, sometimes we have like mid-March blizzards, and I was hoping that that would happen. I'll tell my boss, like, what am I supposed to do? I can't fly in, like, you got a foot of snow. But doesn't sound like that's going to happen, so we have to go back tomorrow. But I'm just, it was such an awesome weekend. I haven't taken a vacation since I went to Florida in a manic panic. I was like, this is like a long time ago, and I don't remember half the trip, you know. It was like, I'm leaving with the clothes on my back. And I came back a week later, but, you know, this is really awesome. It was an incredible retreat, you know, and my church has like a women's retreat next weekend. And I was kind of disappointed because I didn't really have the money to go and stuff, but this has turned out to be like my women's retreat. You know, like, I got to hang out with the girls that I used to live with, and it's just awesome, you guys. The relationships that I have today, it's just awesome, and I'm so grateful for what God has done in my life, and I'm so honored, you know, and privileged to be able to stand up here for a couple minutes and share with you what God has done in my life.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.